Hey guys, this is Rose, and if you're listening to this, you found the Rose Quinn Podcast.
This is the Rose Quinn Podcast.
Treasure rejection.
The community is so great.
It's going to be like my breakout story.
That I realized I really didn't like where my life was.
Yeah.
And I was going to pursue my dreams.
The Rose Quinn Podcast.
This is the Rose Quinn Podcast.
Hey everyone, it's time for another episode. And time for you to hear some more of me rambling on about something I love a lot, writing. Hopefully you love it too, and that's why you're listening to the Rose Quinn Podcast. But before we get started, I want to take care of maybe my favorite part of all the episodes. And that's where I tell you about my favorite books that I've read recently. If you follow me on Instagram, you've seen me post about quite a few books lately. One of them was The Favorite Sister by Jessica Knoll. She's the author of Luckiest Girl Alive, and The Favorite Sister was an amazing follow-up to her first debut novel. It's incredible. Another book I posted about was Only the Dead Know by C.J. Dunford, which is a really awesome mystery crime fiction novel that you should read. And I also posted about Graham Masterson's Ghost Virus, which is an incredibly captivating and gruesome horror novel, but he's so talented, and it was an awesome book if you like horror. It is very graphic. And of course, I posted about Fury Born by Claire Legrand, which came out on May 22nd. And if you haven't read it yet, first of all, what are you doing with your life? Second of all, go buy it right now. It is such an incredible novel. I've read a lot of books this year, but Fury Born is in my top three. It's a really amazing story and has such real, relatable characters. Claire has created something super special. I know that this book has already been one of my favorite books of an episode before, but I don't even care. That's how much I love it. So make sure you follow Claire on Instagram. Her handle is her name, no spaces, nothing extra. And you want to follow her so that you can make sure to not miss anything else that she puts out because she's so talented. The topic for today's episode is something that I think we as writers are all familiar with, that lovely friend of ours that never goes away called imposter syndrome. It's something I've been struggling with lately, and I'm not really sure why, I'm not really sure when it started, I kind of just found myself in the middle of it. I haven't been actively querying, so those lovely rejection emails that we get haven't been pushing me down. I've been working on When Jay Bird Went Missing, my crime fiction novel, after taking a pause on some edits to This Dead World. And when I say edits, I mean like very final edits, very final. I probably have a few days left of them, but I decided to set it aside. Now, as I've thought more about this, I've sort of figured out that it's probably because I'm a little bit scared. Scared of saying that I'm completely done with This Dead World and starting to send that query letter out. Also, maybe a little scared to commit to a query letter because I feel like I am the worst at writing them. But once you send that query letter out, you leave your inbox very open to those lovely form rejection letters. I had great beta readers, K.A. Dowling and S.K. Murphy, who loved my book, but also loved it enough to see through some of the things that I wasn't catching, which helped it become so much better. So I feel confident in the fact that it's not a garbage book, but that imposter syndrome snuck in without me even really knowing. I know that this is something that I'm not alone in. I think we all struggle with this at some point or another, but why? I think it's because we spend so much time alone with our stories and our characters that they become a part of us. They are us to a certain extent. My book is my baby. I know we say that, we call it our book baby, but it really is something that I have poured countless hours into. So that fear and that feeling that I'm not a real writer comes from fearing what others may think, that someone might not like it. So something I've been reminding myself and trying to be real with myself about is that not everybody is going to like what I write. A lot of authors that I've interviewed for this podcast have echoed the same thing. I'm sure you guys have caught on to that. We write our books, we pour our hearts into them, and then we release them into the world. They stop being ours when we do that. They become the readers, and sometimes the readers don't like them. hey, there are books that I have read that I don't like, and that's okay. But it's hard to justify that in my writer brain. Some people will read my book and think it's garbage, but then they aren't who I was writing it for. I will be happy if one person reads my book and connects with it in some way. I would love to have lots of published books someday and have a following of readers, but that's not why I write. I write because the stories inside of me are too full, too overpowering to keep inside just me. I write because I love it. I may not fit the stereotypical picture of a fantastic, successful author, but that doesn't mean that I'm not one. And that doesn't mean that you aren't one either. So how do we get that freaking imposter syndrome off our back to give us a little bit of space? For me, it helped to get out of my house, to put my book away and to connect with friends. I think it helps to connect with other writers and talk about how you're feeling. I guarantee that I'm not the only one who feels like an imposter, and you're not the only one who feels like an imposter. And if you know that someone else out there is feeling the same way you are, it helps just to know that someone else understands those crazy thoughts that are going through your head, that you've spent all this time and effort poring over something and then not believing that it's good. I was scrolling through Pinterest one day and found this quote from Cheryl Strayed, the author of Wild. She said, "Writing is always full of self-doubt, but the first book, Torch, is really full of self-doubt, and it was much more of a struggle to keep the faith. By the time I wrote Wild, I was familiar with that feeling of doubt and self-loathing. So I just thought, okay, this is how it feels to write a book." So this is a reminder to me, to you, to anyone who's struggling with imposter syndrome. Writing is hard, but you have to keep doing it. We love it. That's why we do it. Push through. Even when what you write is terrible, keep going. Don't stop because it'll be that much harder to get back into it. And if you're struggling with imposter syndrome or you need someone to just vent to, you can always reach out to me. I am more than happy to commiserate in your misery with you and try and help you cheer up, because imposter syndrome derailed my writing train for a few weeks, and I know it can be super hard. Okay, so now that we've gotten that out of the way, it's time for our interview with Rae Del Bianco. She is an incredible author with a debut novel, Rough Animals, coming out on June 5th. She is the sweetest, smartest, most lovely Instagram person in the world. You guys need to follow her if you don't, because her feed is out of this world amazing. So sit back with your glass of coffee or your hot chocolate or your tea or your Diet Coke and get to know Rae a little bit before her book comes out and you fall in love with her. So Rae, your debut novel, Rough Animals, comes out on June 5th. Can you give us a little blurb as to what it's about?
Absolutely. So it's a rural thriller. It's one of Southern Living magazine's picks for one of the best books coming out this summer. Publishers Weekly has called it furious and electric, and it's been compared to the work of Cormac McCarthy and Dennis Johnson. So it's come from the point of view of a Utah farmer growing up with his twin on a very isolated ranch, and when a 14-year-old female cartel assassin turns up on the ranch, it sets off a chain of events that force Wyatt, the rancher, to confront his past.
That is so cool. Oh my gosh, wait.
Thank you.
There's so many questions I have. Have you lived in Utah before? Are you from Utah?
I haven't. So I've actually only spent several weeks traveling there, but I grew up raising beef cattle.
Oh my God.
So in terms of the viscerality of working with animals, you know, the sweat, the salt, the feeling, the dirt between your fingers, it's very much still there. So that was in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. So it was more or less, I was able to easily transport those feelings and memories a more rural setting.
Oh my gosh, that book sounds amazing. I can't wait to read it. So tell us a little bit about your journey with this book, you know, from kind from when you started and then to, you know, getting representation and getting it published? Just, I know that's like a huge question, but you can just like bullet point it for us.
No, absolutely. I think I'm not one of those people who said that I wanted to be a writer since, you know, learning to walk. I've always been a reader, and I think a lot of times a love of or a desire to write comes out of a love of reading.
Definitely.
When you're just so desperately passionate about it that you have to contribute. So I really fell in love with writing. I wrote my first full-length novel in college. I think most writers that you'll talk to have a novel that never got published.
Yeah.
And that first one, it's, you kind of realize you have to write, and for any aspiring writers, it's great to know you have to write 80,000 words of bad writing just to get it out, do it, know what it feels like, and then just have it over with. So I did realize while I was in college, I was also pre-med, and I understood that writing is an extremely difficult career path, and looking at the risks, if this were to, you know, turn up not making any money or, you know, really desperate straits here, whether it would be worth it, and I decided I loved it enough that it was. So I spent my first year, I moved in with my 88-year-old grandma in New Jersey, staying with her to be able to write. I worked for a year to try to sell this novel, and it failed again and again. I think I queried every agent in the United States and in the UK. So then I was accepted a year later, accepted to the Curtis Brown Creative Program in London, which is basically like an MFA in terms of workshop style instruction, except it also includes a seminar series on the publishing industry. So they bring in, you know, big and small authors, publishers, agents, and really, really teach you how that works.
That's awesome.
It was really, really unique, and I loved that about it. And the other thing that I didn't quite realize how beneficial it was until I've been talking to other literary writers more recently was that since it was so diverse in terms of genre, you know, we had people in the course who were literary fiction, people who were psychological thriller, police procedural, chick lit, that they held us all to the same standards of writing compelling plots and fascinating characters.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big pitfall with literary fiction, that you can write really beautifully without having that drive and plot and pace that really keeps readers coming back. So it was great to have that kind of instilled in us.
For sure. That's an awesome experience. I'm jealous.
I highly recommend. They have online courses as well. But yeah, so that course ended with getting to put your work in front of the agents. So I was signed with them after that. And then I later turned to the U.S. and queried for an American agent here as well. And then a year later, here I am. So it was 6 months of writing that first draft, and then 2 years between finishing that first draft and getting where I am now.
That's so great. I'm so excited and glad that you got it to that point and didn't give up and, you know, took that chance, because from pre-med to moving in with your grandma to write a book is like a huge decision.
Trust me. I thought that a number of times when it was, you know, 3 years out of college in my pajamas, still trying.
But, you know, that's a writer's life. You got to take the big chances to do it, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, you have to love it that much, because I think loving it that much plays into almost every element of, you know, whether you push yourself that hard to see if you can really, really nail that character and get it right, or, you know, and so on and so on. It's all different types and different expressions of pushing yourself to that level.
Definitely. So before you got into that course and, you know, found your agent through there, you did query, but how did you approach querying, and what were your kind of like takeaways of the good and bad of what to do?
So the best takeaway I had from about querying was that that Curtis Brown course actually spent about 10% of the total instruction time on querying.
Wow.
And that's pretty enormous when you think of, you know, the choosing to devote that time to it. And it really is that important. And, you know, the agent I have now in the U.S., his agency only accepted query letters and not sample chapters.
Mm-hmm.
And under the premise that if you can't write a compelling, exciting query letter, you certainly can't do it in a novel either.
Right.
So, which sounds terrifying. I totally understand.
It's super terrifying.
Yeah. But in the good thing, though, is that it's totally within your control to be able to write this. And I think the best line that came out of the Curtis Brown course was when you were doing an elevator pitch, and then, you know, that also applies to your query letter. It should be your header line.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to perfectly, accurately, or completely sum up your book. What you have to do is get somebody to say, tell me more.
Right.
And that was the kind of, you know, how do you say something that it's so easy to test it on yourself once you learn that if you can just say this hook line and say, would that interest me?
Right.
And most of the time, if it's just a dry statement, of course not.
No.
exactly. And you can really kind of self-police there, because there are a limited number of opportunities with agents and whatnot. I think
Definitely.
It is really important to be prepared and well-informed before you go there.
I think that's a great way to think about it, because I like to go through Agent Query Connect and read people's query letters, because it helps me, I feel like, to read other people's and see where they're going. But I feel like a lot of mm-hmm. times we try and put our whole entire novel into 250 words instead of, you know, what you were saying is just get someone to want to read more, or, you know, tell me more, and not, like, let's
exactly.
give away everything, which I feel like it's hard to do, to differentiate
yeah.
and to pull yourself back from just throwing everything on the page of the query letter.
It's that feeling that you're afraid to leave anything out in case
yes.
that would have been the thing to tip the scales.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, I totally get that. And I started really relying, when I started pushing towards a 250 word query letter and doing it super brief, and realizing that, you know, we don't have the opportunity to not leave anything out, because their attention span is so, so short. They're
yeah.
looking for, they receive hundreds and hundreds of emails a week. They're looking for reasons to reject people.
Yeah.
So to try to get that bite and that hook in there right away, have it be really short and really compelling, does so much more than shoving in information. So one of the things that I thought worked really, really well in my query was, and in your second paragraph, you do a bit more of a description of the book, maybe 1 to 3 sentences about it. And I deleted everything about plot besides the first sentence.
Hmm.
And I instead used terms to, like, color it in. So, you know, the plot of the novel, you know, it's from Box Elder County, Utah, to Monument Valley. There's, like, all these details that happen. But instead I said, you know, in a world of burning pickup trucks, knife fights in Walmart, and an ecstasy
yes.
factory in an old greenhouse, why its principles start to slip, et cetera, et cetera, and tied into the plot. But that gave you a lot more color, knife fights at Walmart,
yeah.
than saying, then they went here, and then they went there, and then...
yeah, definitely. Oh, I love that. That, like, blew
yeah.
my mind a little bit, because querying is where... querying, I get in my head too much about it, and it's hard once you've written, you know, 10 queries, and I'm one of those where I get stuck in putting everything on the page. So I love to know
yep.
all the tips and tricks about it.
Absolutely. You just got to remember to try to put in what's exciting about your book, and put in your personality, and kind of how would you speak if someone you cared about were to ask about your book and you were excited to speak about it.
Yeah.
Versus giving a book report.
Right. a grade school book report. Nobody wants
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
No. Oh my gosh, that is such a good tip. So I love that you said, you know, a love of reading can really create a want to write, because I feel like I kind of went down that same path. I've always been a reader, an avid reader. I used to sit as a kid and just, like, ignore my family and read books. And I think you're right.
Too.
Like, yeah, that definitely gave me this desire to create my own stories and, you know, give feelings to people like I got from books and the way I was connected to authors. So mm-hmm. I love that you said that. But as a writer, for you, what is the hardest part of writing? And then now as a new author, what's the hardest part of being an author?
So the hardest part of writing, and it's something that I'm actively working on, is understanding that sometimes you have to go down the wrong path with a plot or an idea in order to know that it won't work.
Yes.
And to try to forgive yourself instead of turning around and saying, I just threw away 30,000 words in an entire month worth of work. You have to understand that a creative process is so convoluted and such a mystery and really such a gift.
Yeah.
That it's... There's no real point in questioning it, and if it took you to where you are now, then it was worth it. Yeah. And to try not to give yourself grief for quote-unquote wasted days, because there are no wasted days.
Yeah, no. I love that.
Yeah. And then, so the hardest part about being an author, I barely feel like an author yet.
You are, though. You are.
I'm still at grandma's in my pajamas.
That's okay. That's like the best place to be.
Yeah, it's, so I haven't hit the hardest part about it yet. I think it's really just magic at this point, because for the very first time, people are starting to read my book and advanced copies and whatnot. And, you know, when I was writing, I was just so focused on the story and trying to render it as best as I could. So the idea that something that has had a huge impact on my life has had an impact on other people's lives is, like, too cool to be true. It's really freaking me out in the best possible way.
That's so awesome. So that's kind of your best part of being an author.
Exactly. Yes. I can't think of a hardest part yet. Ask me in 3 months.
Okay, we'll do a follow-up, and I'll ask you just that question. What's the hardest part of being an author after your book has come out?
Probably not getting to sleep, I'm sure.
Probably. Well, so you've told us your best part of being an author. What's the best part of writing for you?
It's hard to say it without sounding cheesy.
Just cheese it up. I love cheese.
Yes. I mean, writing, like, makes my world in color. Yeah. You know, everything would go dry without it. And it's Absalom, Absalom by William Faulkner is my favorite novel, because it takes a singular moment between two people and just gives it infinite meaning, whether it's a friendship, a family, whatever. And just, I love that idea that you can expand and contract your own experiences by choosing what you examine. And you can give any little detail to your life infinite meaning by pursuing it in art and in writing. Yeah. And that just gives so much worth and so much value to every single waking moment in life. And I think it's a really beautiful way to look at the world.
I love that. Oh, it was like cheese, and then it was like the most beautiful thing you could have said.
I'm glad to hear it.
Yes. So my next question, I love to know, because I feel like sometimes people change whether or not they are, you know, like, spend a lot of time outlining, or do they just sit down and write. So what do you consider yourself, a pantser, a planner, or somewhere in between, like a plotzer?
Well, I've never heard the term pantser before, and I love it. That's great.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you just write by the seat of your pants.
We need to make that a thing.
Yes.
It's so true.
Yeah.
I think we all wish we were planners, and then we all end up chucking our plans out the window.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I have so many notebooks that I've filled up, and I go back and look and just kind of laugh at where on earth I thought I was going. One thing, I think this might actually be a vaguely helpful piece of advice, it was for me at least, was that we constantly, as writers, tend to compress our novels in our minds, and that, like, 85,000 words, 300 pages is so big of a project for one person.
It is.
And we always, for me at least, I constantly shrunk it in my mind to think of it as something more palatable and kind of get my mind around it. And then when I would actually sit down to do the work, all of my plans were too basic and too small to have any sort of control over this beast that was very much out of my hands.
Yeah.
So it was good to have a vague idea of where I was going, and to also have intention of where I wanted the book to end up, but I was just pantser all the time.
Love it. I'm definitely a pantser. I don't know. I feel like I just struggled with planning, because I'm a control freak, so I'd be like, okay, have to stick to what I wrote down. And then, you know, you get to that point where you're like, no, this isn't working. And so then I would just get frustrated. So I try to write as little notes as possible and just really see to the pants, by the seat of your pants, and just write as whatever I'm feeling.
That's
that
great.
Day. You do a lot of editing that way, but it's fine.
Yeah, well, like we said, you know, sometimes you just have to do that. And it's, you can't tell if it's going to work until you write it. So to stick with something you know isn't working is the only way you could waste time. So it's great to be able to be fluid and spontaneous.
Yeah. Let's see. I feel like I'm switching up the next question on you a little bit, and you may have sort of answered it. But you were talking about how your love of reading kind of spurred your love of writing. But do you remember, and maybe it was that Faulkner book you were talking about, but do you remember if there was a book that kind of made, that you read and you're like, oh my gosh, I want to write something like as good as this?
Tender as the Night by F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Love it.
I was in high school, senior year of high school, and you had to pair a fiction book with a nonfiction book, and I paired it with, Tender as the Night was based on, I'm blanking out on their names, but two of F. Scott Fitzgerald and Zelda's very close friends, Sarah and Gerald Murphy, that was okay. Their names, and he very closely paralleled them in real life to the point at which, of course, their friendship broke up. It was disastrous. This was a party that the woman had a mental illness and was also extremely, extremely wealthy, and the husband became a failed artist who had no interest in art but just really felt emasculated by his wife's wealth. It was so just a crazier party couple than Zelda and Scott.
Yeah.
And Scott predicted their downfall in the book.
Oh, no.
And, yeah, and so Sarah and Gerald, of course, cut him off and stopped being friends. 5 years later, it turned out that Scott was exactly right.
Wow.
And he predicted exactly down to, like, a sickness of their child from a result of their partying. And it was just so, for the first time, I saw fiction as being something to be taken completely seriously in its role in human life and the way it portrays us. And it just really hit me that I was, you know, very inclined in science and math and whatnot. But that was, it's a beautiful work and it's heartbreaking too. And it just made fiction larger than life. And I think that's something to think about too, is often, you know, you hear about stories sometimes. I think it was Elena Ferrante said, none of it happened, but all of it's true. Mm-hmm. And that sometimes fiction can be even more true than our history.
I think so, too. Yeah. That's so awesome. I love that story. My gosh, Ray, you have the best answers to all my questions.
You ask great questions.
Oh, well, thank you. So my last question I love to ask because, I love to read, duh. But I just love to know what everyone else is reading. So what is a favorite book of yours that you've read recently or that you're excited for it to come out? Besides your own book.
Yeah. So I'm reading Already Dead by Dennis Johnson right now.
Ooh.
And Dennis Johnson is my complete obsession. I wasn't familiar with his work until this summer, and Jim Shepherd, a fantastic author, gave a lecture on his story Emergency from his story collection Jesus Son. Dennis Johnson just passed away this past year, and his final collection of stories, The Largesse of the Sea Maiden, came out in January, and it's very bittersweet to read knowing it's the last, but Already Dead is the story. It's 1990s rural Northern California, and, you know, trailer parks and just crazy people in the best kind of way. And it's basically this man is quickly going insane as a result of PTSD and resulting drug use when he saves a man who was attempting to commit suicide in his pond.
Oh, gosh.
And the premise is that this man, you know, thinks he's died because his last memory was of him committing suicide.
Yeah.
And this, you know, mentally troubled man wants him to do something for him. And he claims that, well, you're already dead, so it doesn't make a difference. It's really fascinating to me. But what Dennis does is he writes about the lowest of the low and people who are just have absolutely destroyed lives physically and mentally and really struggling. And he brings out the light things and the good things about their experiences. And he just shows so much redemption and struggle. And I think that that's the best that I could ever hope to do with my art is to look difficult and sad and dirty things honestly in the face and say, you know what? Life is still beautiful. People are still good. There are still things worth it out there.
I love it. And I love that you called it art because I think a lot of times, and sometimes it feels like work, but I think, you know, we have to remember it is an art and a form of art that you're putting out there in the world because that's the perfect
way
to put it. We forget that sometimes.
Because it's so unglamorous in the moment to be writing it. And when you try to, and like I said, when I was actually writing, I couldn't even think past the page. But the idea that somebody else could read it and gain something from it is really incredible and makes all the work so worthwhile.
Oh, so awesome. Oh, love it. See, you're just literally the best answers. Okay, one thing that I just thought of that I want to ask you is your Instagram is amazing.
Thank you.
How much time does it take you to, like, plan it and take those pictures and all of that? Just as, you know, a fellow Instagrammer, I just love to pick people's brains.
So, absolutely. I actually, I will let you in on a secret. I do the photos in bursts.
Okay.
Since, you know, creativity definitely wanes, so sometimes I'll do 10 pictures in a day.
Yeah.
And meter those out. The ones with the horse and outdoors are actually a lot easier than the flat lays.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I probably spend 10 hours a week on it, about. Okay. It's definitely, a lot of the time is spent having those really engaging conversations that always inevitably arise, and that's what really makes it worthwhile for me.
Yeah, that's so awesome. I find that I do that too. I take a lot of pictures and I'll, you know, like do 5 different pictures in a day, so then I don't have to take them for a while.
Exactly. And when you start getting used to, there's things like lighting and whatnot that get so picky.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I just love it. I remember when I followed you on Instagram, you know, that's how I found you. I was like, this Instagram is incredible. I want to be more like her.
You're so great. I love that we connected on there. And I never really imagined that Bookstagram would be such a, like, alive, loving community as it really is. And that there's, you know, genuine friendships spring up out of this Bookstagram thing. And it's been one of the most rewarding things I've ever done.
It really has surprised me. I did an interview yesterday, and I felt the same thing, and I feel like with writers and Bookstagrammers, book people are the best people, in my opinion.
Yes,
and
100%.
I just feel like the writing community is so different from some other art communities, where we all want each other to succeed. We're all happy when someone gets a book, you know, a book deal.
Yeah,
and then,
absolutely.
You know, we all are going to work together, and we want everybody to get to that point. It's not like, oh, no, I don't want to help you because I never want your book to be published because I want to be more famous than you. Like,
exactly.
That doesn't really happen in our community, which I think is just
no.
a beautiful thing.
It really is. I heard another writer put it really well the other day, that they said, well, selfishly, as a reader, I want all of these good books to be published.
Yeah.
And I love that idea that if we are all readers who absolutely love books, so yes, I want all of your great books, and I want to read all of them, and
exactly.
I want every success for all of you guys,
yeah.
you know?
And I want all the other readers out there to have access to all the great, like, I do a lot of beta reading for some of my...
Me too, I love it.
Oh my gosh, it's my favorite, but then I'm, like, mad because I'm, like, you know, one of the few people who gets to read that, and I want it to be published and for the whole world, and I want to talk about it and put it out there for these people, because they're just, I mean, there's some seriously talented people, and I just love that about the writing community. So I'm so glad we got to connect to and do this, and that you have your book coming out. I'm so excited for you.
Me too. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
This was an absolute blast getting to chat.
Ray, thank you so much for chatting with me today. And everyone, make sure to go and get Rough Animals. It comes out on June 5th.